Let's talk about the somatoform disorders. We're making a change now to a different class of disorders from the anxiety disorders. Yes, they are related, but these are disorders in their own right. We're going to talk about the different somatoform disorders, and then we're going to go on and talk about the differential between somatoform disorders, factitious disorder, and malingering. Somatoform disorders as a whole are the overuse of what defense mechanism? This is hard. Somatization, of course. Somatoform disorders, there are three subtypes, and you're expected, there are five subtypes, pardon me, and you're expected to be able to do the simple differential among the subtypes, beginning with somatization disorder. Somatization disorder is a set of eight or more symptoms. You don't give somatization disorder when someone's just got a couple of symptoms. There's got to be a whole bunch. How many? Eight or more. And they must have a particular profile. It has to be four pain symptoms, two GI symptoms, one sexual functioning symptom, and one pseudoneurological symptom. Do I have to have the symptoms all at once? No. But they should be identified over a period of years. The idea here in somatization disorder, the idea by this definition, eight or more, is to prevent you from giving this diagnosis to somebody that just has a few symptoms. We're holding on to this and just giving it to people that are extreme, that have enough symptoms to make them dysfunctional. Onset must be prior to age 30. And although somatization disorder can occur in either gender, it's much more common in women by about a 20-to-1 ratio. Conversion disorder. Conversion disorder is usually a single symptom issue. It's the altering of physical functioning, suggesting a physical problem, but it's the consequence of psychological ideology. Anytime something doesn't match the criterion, because you don't have enough symptoms for somatization disorder, this is probably what you're going to fall to, conversion disorder. Conversion disorder most often affects skeletal muscular functioning or one of the primary senses, especially hearing or vision. Example. Patient appears presenting with a paralyzed left hand. They can't move their left hand. Now, if this is conversion disorder, let's be clear. This is conversion disorder. If they really need to move that hand, can they move it? Answer, no. It's just as paralyzed as if it's a neurological condition. They're not faking it. They're not trying to pull one over on you. They've lost functioning. The difference is not symptomatology. It's etiology. It's the source of the symptom. So you need to do a differential here and understand whether this is conversion disorder, psychological in etiology, or whether this is some neurological problem. How do you do that? Hey, it's hard. Anyone that tells you this is easy is lying. This is not an easy differential. How do you do it? Here's two suggestions. Let's take out a pin and let's look at the extent of the paralysis. Let's say you discover the extent of the paralysis is right around the base of the hand. Well, folks, is that the way the neurons run? Does that match your basic understanding of anatomy and physiology? No? Well, then it's probably a conversion disorder. Second, look for what we call labelle indifference in my worst French accent, or labelle indifference in my Midwestern accent. Labelle indifference is the lack of something. It's the lack of the expected distress reaction to having the symptom. Come on, you wake up tomorrow and your left hand is paralyzed. Wouldn't that be a source of concern? Wouldn't you be distressed? Wouldn't that be the major preoccupation of your day? Sure it would. Yet your patient is sitting before you saying, oh, well, doc, I guess I just have to learn to live with this. Excuse me? That kind of lack of concern, labelle indifference, it's symptomatic of conversion disorder. By the way, what defense mechanism is this? Labelle indifference is the result of what particular defense mechanism? Not denial. I can't move my hand. That's the way it is. It's actually isolation of affect. What's missing here? What's missing is the normal human responsiveness to the symptom. Hypochondriasis is next up. Hypochondriasis doesn't mean you have anything wrong with you, really. It means you think you have something wrong with you. It's an unrealistic interpretation of physical signs, seeing signs as symptoms. This is a simple way to think about this. In order to have the diagnosis, you have to have this perception for at least 6 months. This is not a temporary issue. This is an enduring issue. When you come and evaluate, when you do a physical exam on someone who has hypochondriasis, everything should be within the normal range. Although the patient is convinced that there's something horribly wrong. Now, be careful here, folks, because real life experience tells us that physicians tend to overdiagnose hypochondriasis by about a 4-to-1 ratio. For every 4 cases you think you see, 1 is real. You're wrong about the other 3. How then do you do this diagnosis for hypochondriasis? Because if every time you can't find anything wrong, you say, ah, they're hypochondriac, no, you're more likely to be wrong than right. How do you do the differential? Easy. Shut up and get the patient to talk to you. Don't pepper them with detailed questions about their symptoms. Don't keep getting lab value after lab value. You think of hypochondriasis, say to the patient, well, tell me more about that symptom. If they come in complaining of back pain, well, tell me more about your back pain. Well, it's this sharp stabbing pain over here on the left, and sometimes I feel this numbness in my neck, a ringing in my ear, and I sometimes feel like I'm about to lose my balance. It's hard to get around like this because I don't see my children much anymore. I don't know why they don't come to visit. You have hypochondriasis on your hand. Do you hear it? You get the symptom generalizing across the body, across the soma, and then bing, out into the general social world. Once you've broken that boundary, it's probably hypochondriasis, okay? You're convinced the patient has hypochondriasis. Now what? What action should you take? Well, you have hypochondriasis. Nothing's wrong with it. Of course not. If you give them that little speech, they're going to leave and go find a real physician that'll help me, and you won't be able to help them. What should you do? It's simple. You give them a palliative intervention, something that responds to the symptom, but not in a way that does any harm, and then you schedule to see them again. Because the cure for the hypochondriac is going to come out of the relationship they have with you. If you say to me, why am I scheduling to see them again? They have nothing wrong. You're not listening to me. Yes, they have something wrong. They have hypochondriasis. And it's your relationship with them that will produce an understanding of the motive and therefore the cure. Somatoform pain disorder. Somatoform pain disorder is basically conversion to pain. We have a separate diagnostic category here because, well, pain is a particular kind of symptom. In particular, pain is entirely subjective. How do I know that you hurt? I have to take your word for it. I have no clear way of measuring that. To have somatoform pain disorder, we're talking not just temporary, but severe, prolonged pain and pain that disrupts day-to-day life. It makes it impossible for you to do your normal, everyday activities. How do you know whether the pain the patient has is somatoform pain disorder or whether it's the result of some physical issue that you haven't detected? Folks, once again, this is tough. And anyone that tells you it's not is frankly lying. But we do have some hints. The main hint is look for something we call secondary gain. Now, we haven't talked about secondary gain yet, so let's do the definitions. Primary gain is something you get internally for having the symptom. It's relief from bad feeling or getting a good feeling. Secondary gain is something you get from the world around you. Relief from responsibility, drugs, money, something like attention even from the outside. That's secondary gain. Somatoform pain disorder, like all of the somatoform disorders, will have primary gain but also secondary gain. Simple example of secondary gain. A husband and wife present in your office. The husband begins speaking saying, I want you to understand my wife is a wonderful wife and mother. She takes wonderful care of our 13 children, wouldn't dream of having any help. She takes immaculate care of our 37-room mansion, wouldn't dream of having a maid. She does it all herself. She's always there for us. But we're becoming concerned. Yes, she says, breaking at this point, because I've been developing these headaches, which are so terrible, I just can't do my job. And the only thing that seems to help is I draw a hot bath and we put on some light music and I lay in the bathtub for half an hour and then the headache goes away. But the headache's becoming more and more severe. Do you suspect somatoform pain disorder? Of course you do. Why? What's the secondary gain? Well, it's the only time the poor woman gets a break. The only time she gets any time off is to have pain. What's your intervention? What response do you have? My intervention here is clear. I'm going to give her the gain without having her have to have the pain in the first place. Every Saturday from 8 in the morning till 10 at night is your time. You're not to take care of your husband, the children, anything. It's your time. If I'm right, the pain will disappear. And finally, the fifth of the somatoform disorders is body dysmorphic disorder. Body dysmorphic disorder is a weird one, folks. These people are preoccupied. Their entire life is focused around their impression that they just look terrible. You look at them, they look perfectly normal, but they are convinced they are just butt ugly, no matter what anybody tells them. In severe forms, they spend long days, hours, with their face pressed up against the mirror in the bathroom, talking out loud, stream of consciousness, just about how butt ugly they think they are. Because of this, these people are particularly vulnerable to going and getting multiple plastic surgeries. They get one plastic surgery after another, after another, after another, but they're never satisfied. Why? Because the problem is not in how they actually look. So the problem is how they perceive themselves. It's an illusion. They have a misperception of themselves in that mirror. Now, sometimes, if you're not careful, you might confuse anorexia nervosa with body dysmorphic disorder. You need not. Because anorexia nervosa is focused on, I'm fat. I may be ugly, but it's because I'm primarily fat. Body dysmorphic disorder, it's I'm ugly. Often the focus is on the face, but it may be focused on a part of the body, not so much about being overweight, but misshapen or not correctly proportioned would be a better way to think about it here. If a patient comes in and gets 1, 2, 3 plastic surgeries and you're not beginning to suspect body dysmorphic disorder, you're not doing your job, doctor. All of these together, all five of these, constitute the somatoform disorders. Somatoform disorders share the following things in common. Symptom production, the fact that you made these symptoms, is unconscious. You don't know that you did it. And the reason, the motivation why you'd have these symptoms is also unconscious. You don't know that you're doing it, and you wouldn't know why you were doing it anyhow. Let's contrast that with fictitious disorder and malingering. In factitious disorder, something is known. You know that you're creating the symptoms. You know you took that drug. You know you twisted yourself a certain way. You know you did an activity in order to produce that particular set of symptoms. Unfortunately, it's beyond your control to stop. Factitious disorder is a psychiatric condition because people are literally out of control. They know what they're doing, but they can't stop doing it. Most common presentation of factitious disorder is Munchausen syndrome. These are people that show up in medical settings having manufactured real identifiable medical symptoms in order to get medical intervention and even surgical procedures performed on them. They're going to show up and they're going to have all the textbook symptoms of acute appendicitis. Everything Harrison says they should have, they will have. You know why? They read Harrison's. Everything in the book they're going to have. And you operate and you remove the appendix and you find out from pathology it was perfectly normal. Oh well, no harm done. 3 months later, they're back. All the textbook symptoms of an inflamed gallbladder. You schedule them for laparoscopy, remove the gallbladder, pathology shows it was fine. If you haven't caught on to the fact this is Munchausen syndrome by now, you're not doing your job. And so you think the patient has Munchausen syndrome. Now what? Do I confront them? You're really manufacturing these symptoms in yourself. No, remember, it's beyond their control to stop. If I confront them, they'll merely leave, go to another medical setting, and now the doctors will have to figure that out all by themselves. What should I do? What you're supposed to do is, again, work the relationship. You're supposed to get a sense of what is the underlying motive that is causing them to produce these symptoms. Here's one suggestion used by a doctor in the hospital where I work. They decided this patient that kept showing up with what they believed to be manufactured symptoms was doing so because they really liked being around the hospital, talking to the doctors and nurses, being in the hospital setting, and so they arranged for this person to become a hospital volunteer. Now the person would go around, pass out flowers, newspapers, talk to the doctors and nurses, and you know what? They stopped showing up with symptoms. If you can get the underlying motive satisfied, you get the disappearance of symptoms. The borderline between psychiatric cases and non-psychiatric cases is not between cephaliform and fictitious, it's between factitious and malingering. Malingering is all about secondary gain. Another way to say that, everything is known. You know that you're creating the symptoms and you know why you're creating the symptoms. It's all within your control. You can stop if you want to. Now you need to understand clearly the differential here between somatoform, factitious, and malingering is not in symptom presentation. All these could present with the exact same symptoms. The differential here is what you know. If you know everything, it's malingering. If you know something, it's factitious. If you know nothing, it's somatoform disorder. Malingering is all about secondary gain. People are doing it to get things. Workman's compensation. Money in a lawsuit, drugs, because you're an addict, you show up at the emergency department faking abdominal pain in order to get morphine-based painkiller. This is what we talk about when we talk about malingering. Factitious disorder does need and require your psychiatric intervention. Malingering, no, we're talking more legal issues here. Post-traumatic stress disorder is both much tested and much misunderstood. Let's take a look at the symptoms here. Re-experience of the event as recurrent dreams, recollections, or flashbacks. Avoidance of associated stimuli. Now those are the big two, because everything else after that is generally non-specific. Diminished responsiveness, sleep disruption or excess, irritability, impulsivity, inability to concentrate, headaches, and repetition compulsions. So it can be misdiagnosed as obsessive-compulsive disorder if you're not careful. Most of those symptoms are diffuse and nonspecific, so let's go back and focus on the first two. Re-experience of events. You're having dreams, you're having nightmares probably, you're having flashbacks, you think the event is happening to you in real time, and avoidance of associated stimuli. What do we mean by avoidance of associated stimuli? Well, a woman who's raped in a stairwell now can only take elevators. A Vietnam veteran finds himself incapable of eating in restaurants that feature ceiling fans. The ceiling fans reminding him of the blades of the helicopters that transported the troops in Vietnam. That's what we mean by avoidance of associated stimuli. Unless you have those two symptoms, both of them, you probably are not looking at PTSD. Even with those symptoms, other criteria are required. In order to have a diagnosis of PTSD, you must have your symptoms over 1 month. If you have your PTSD type symptoms for less than a month, we slap a different label on it. We call it acute stress disorder, ASD. Also note that PTSD is a response to events that are outside the realm of normal human experience. This is not an overreaction to ordinary events. This is an excessive reaction to extraordinary events, once in a lifetime trauma, a threat to self, family, home, a threat to your very way of life and your way of being. It's a very common reaction in women who have been raped, and that accounts for many of the cases that we see today. Now, often, there can be a long latency period. For example, someone who is abused as a child may develop because of that PTSD symptoms later in life. Quicker onset, however, correlates with better prognosis. So if you're going to get PTSD symptoms, what you want to do is get them quickly, not years later, but immediately. Recovery is much enhanced. people are increasingly vulnerable to PTSD if they have, well, prior emotional variability, that is, excessive reactions to things that happen to them. Excessive reaction to what we call startle stimuli. Look up here a second.
Whoa!
If you jump when I did that, that's excessive reaction to startle stimuli. If you simply look up and say, huh, well, that's something we've already talked about. Prior cocaine or opiate usage also make people more susceptible to PTSD. It's a correlation here, not necessarily a causal understanding. Prevalence is higher for PTSD in women. 1.2% for women, about 0.5% for men. If that seems counterintuitive, I ask you to recall the rape issue as mentioned before. Therapy. All you need to do to cure someone with PTSD, yeah, it's simple. Just have them to get them to go back mentally and relive the trauma and vent or purge, let go of all the bottled up emotions. That's easy, right? Of course not. What you're asking them to do is go back and relive what is not metaphorically but actually the worst thing that ever happened to them in their entire life. The last thing they want to do is go back and relive that. And so group therapy is your best modality. In group therapy, they're going to be sitting with a supportive environment, the nest-like environment of the group, where they can have support to confront their emotions, where they can watch other people working through their traumas and see what the positive outcome would be. Adjustment disorder is next. What you need to know about adjustment disorder is really the first point here. It's a residual category. Translation, you only give this if no other Axis I diagnosis applies, period. That means if you're reading an exam question, you think, could be adjustment disorder, but it also looks like it could be major depression. Stop, you just answered the question. It's major depression. Why? Because if it could be something else, it is something else. Even if you can't give any other Axis I diagnosis, you only get to give adjustment disorder if you match criterion. What are the criterion? One, presence of an identifiable stressor within 3 months. Two, symptoms have to last less than 6 months. This is something that will resolve on itself. Three, symptoms have to be significant. We're talking about significant deterioration in your relationships with other people, your job performance, your academic performance, your capacity to cope with life. Often you find adjustment disorder presented in regards to teenagers. Somebody who had been a reasonable student doing well in school now is failing school, getting into trouble with the police, getting traffic tickets. That suggests an adjustment disorder. One more thing, a critical last criterion. You can't get an adjustment disorder as a grief response. Why? The book says so. It's definitional. If somebody watches their twin brother be killed by a bus, and then in the succeeding several months, they have difficulty in the relations with others, they get fired from their job, they have a hard time just getting out of bed in the morning. What's your response? What's your diagnosis here? Not adjustment disorder. It's probably, in fact, normal grief. Now, if the symptoms get more severe, they could verge into depression, but what I just gave you is probably nothing more than normal grief. Again, adjustment disorder cannot be a grief response.